My name is Ingrid Christiansen, and I am a teacher in Chicago. I'm delighted to be here. I'm also a mother and a daughter. So, and I suspect practically everybody in this room is one of those things. There are a few fathers here.
Can you talk into the microphone, please?
Sure. You want to hear me? Have you got a listening device on? You could, Doris, we can get one. Would you do that? Thanks. And then I'll pin something on and you'll
She's
pin.
She's going to get a listening device.
Good. Great. I know there are lots of issues about mothers and daughters, and the story I'm going to read of Alice Walker's won't get at them all. But it will get at some issues about mothers and daughters. It's a fairly short story, so it'll leave us a good amount of time to discuss. I thought I pinned something on that was a little. Hey, you, read this. Turn the power off after use. Do you suppose that means it?
There
you
is
should
an on-off switch on the side.
Turn the power on before use?
Yeah, that way.
Now, Doris, can you hear me? Doris? Can you hear me?
Not yet. I didn't have mine turned on.
I didn't have mine on either. Okay. Are we in business now?
I think we're
okay, good. Great, modern technology. So this story, as I was saying, won't do everything that you're interested in today. And we can certainly, since we sort of have two subjects, we have the story and we have issues of mothers and daughters, we could move on from the story to other kinds of issues in the latter part of the session. But the story does some things, and it provides a focus, I think. It does help us think about the issues of sameness or difference with our mothers or our daughters. So lifestyle questions, political questions, where the person would live, where the mother or daughter would live in relation to the other, questions of control and freedom, including the images of the mother and the images of the daughter, how we choose to present ourselves to the world. All of those things are in this story. The story is about heritage, and it takes a heritage question quite seriously, I think. I find it very helpful. My heritage is Norwegian, and when I think about how I pick and choose from among the various things about being Norwegian to use or manifest in my own life, I think that this story helps me to do that kind of work. So I like the story a lot. Mothers and daughters have to reconcile a common history. We were raised together. I mean, we lived together. If you're a daughter, you lived with your mother for the first many years of your life, most likely. That common history, you each remember differently and experience differently, and that constantly impacts how you interact as adults. So the story talks about that, too. I think it's a pretty interesting story. Alice Walker is a woman, a black woman, American. She's about my age. I'm 47. I think she probably is too, in fact. So I think I'll read the story, and then we'll go from there. The story has a lot of images about light and darkness in it that you might want to pay attention to, in addition to the things I've already mentioned. Also, I would think if I were you, as I was listening, what are the gifts that each person in this story brings to the situation? Because I think each person does bring gifts. The story is called Everyday Use for Your Grandmama by Alice Walker. I will wait for her in the yard that Maggie and I made so clean and wavy yesterday afternoon. A yard like this is more comfortable than most people know. It is not just a yard. It is like an extended living room. When the hard clay is swept clean as a floor and the fine sand around the edges lined with tiny irregular grooves, anyone can come and sit and look up into the elm tree and wait for the breezes that never come inside the house. Maggie will be nervous until after her sister goes. She will stand hopelessly in corners, homely and ashamed of the burn scars down her arms and legs, eyeing her sister with a mixture of envy and awe. She thinks her sister has held life always in the palm of one hand, that no is a word the world never learned to say to her. You've no doubt seen those TV shows where the child who has made it is confronted as a surprise by her own mother and father tottering in weakly from backstage. A pleasant surprise, of course. What would they do if parent and child came on the show only to curse out and insult each other? On TV, mother and child embrace and smile into each other's faces. Sometimes the mother and father weep. The child wraps them in her arms and leans across the table to tell how she would not have made it without their help. I have seen these programs. Sometimes I dream a dream in which Dee and I are suddenly brought together on a TV program of this sort. Out of a dark and soft-seated limousine, I am ushered into a bright room filled with many people. There I meet a smiling, gray, sporty man like Johnny Carson, who shakes my hand and tells me what a fine girl I have. Then we are on stage, and Dee is embracing me with tears in her eyes. She pins on my dress a large orchid, even though she has told me once that she thinks orchids are tacky flowers. In real life, I am a large, big-boned woman with rough, man-working hands. In the winter, I wear flannel nightgowns to bed and overalls during the day. I can kill and clean a hog as mercilessly as a man. My fat keeps me hot in zero weather. I can work outside all day, breaking ice to get water for washing. I can eat pork liver cooked over the open fire 5 minutes after it comes steaming from the hog. One winter I knocked a bull calf straight in the brain between the eyes with a sledgehammer and had the meat hung up to chill before nightfall. But of course, all this does not show on television. I am the way my daughter would want me to be, 100 pounds lighter, my skin like an uncooked barley pancake. My hair glistens in the hot, bright lights. Johnny Carson has much to do to keep up with my quick and witty tongue. But that is a mistake. I know even before I wake up. Who ever knew a Johnson with a quick tongue? Who can even imagine me looking at a strange white man in the eye? It seems to me I have talked to them always with 1 foot raised in flight, with my head turned in whichever way is farthest from them. Dee, though, she would always look anyone in the eye. Hesitation was no part of her nature. "How do I look, Mama?" Maggie says, showing just enough of her thin body, enveloped in pink skirt and red blouse, for me to know that she's there, almost hidden by the door. "Come out into the yard," I say. Have you ever seen a lame animal, perhaps a dog run over by some careless person rich enough to own a car, sidle up to someone who is ignorant enough to be kind to him? That is the way my Maggie walks. She has been like this, chin on chest, eyes on ground, feet in shuffle, ever since the fire that burned the other house to the ground. Dee is lighter than Maggie, with nicer hair and a fuller figure. She's a woman now, though sometimes I forget. How long ago was it that other house burned? 10, 12 years? Sometimes I can still hear the flames and feel Maggie's arms sticking to me, her hair smoking and her dress falling off her in little black papery flakes. Her eyes seemed stretched open, blazed open by the flames reflected in them. And Dee, I see her standing off under the sweet gum tree she used to dig gum out of, a look of concentration on her face as she watched the last dingy gray board of the house fall in toward the red-hot brick chimney. "Why don't you do a dance around the ashes?" I'd wanted to ask her. She had hated the house that much. I used to think she hated Maggie, too. But that was before we raised the money, the church and me, to send her to Augusta to school. She used to read to us without pity, forcing words, lies, other folks' habits, whole lives upon us too, sitting trapped and ignorant underneath her voice. She washed us in a river of make-believe, burned us with a lot of knowledge we didn't necessarily need to know, pressed us to her with a serious way she read, to shove us away at just the moment, like dimwits, we seemed about to understand. Dee wanted nice things, a yellow organdy dress to wear to her graduation from high school, black pumps to match a green suit she'd made from an old suit somebody gave me. She was determined to stare down any disaster in her efforts. Her eyelids would not flicker for minutes at a time. Often I fought off the temptation to shake her. At 16, she had a style of her own, and she knew what style was. I never had an education myself. After second grade, the school was closed down. Don't ask me why. In 1927, colored asked fewer questions than they do now. Sometimes Maggie reads to me. She stumbles along good-naturedly, but she can't see well. She knows she is not bright. Like good looks and money, quickness passed her by. She will marry John Thomas, who has mossy teeth and an earnest face. And then I'll be free to sit here and I guess just sing church songs to myself. Although I never was a good singer. Never could carry a tune. I was always better at a man's job. I used to love to milk till I was hooked in the side in 49. Cows are soothing and slow and don't bother you unless you try to milk them the wrong way. I have deliberately turned my back on the house. It is three rooms, just like the one that burned, except the roof is tin. They don't make shingle roofs anymore. There are no real windows, just some holes cut in the side, like the portholes in a ship, but not round and not square, with rawhide holding the shutters up on the outside. This house is in a pasture, too, like the other one. No doubt when Dee sees it, she will want to tear it down. She wrote to me once that no matter where we chose to live, she will manage to come and see us. But she will never bring her friends. Maggie and I thought about this, and Maggie asked me, Mama, when did Dee ever have any friends? She had a few. Furtive boys in pink shirts hanging about on wash day after school. Nervous girls who never laughed. Impressed with her, they worshipped the well-turned phrase, the cute shape, the scalding humor that erupted like bubbles in lie. She read to them. When she was courting Jimmy T, she didn't have much time to pay to us, but turned all her fault-finding power on him. He flew to marry a cheap city girl from a family of ignorant, flashy people. She hardly had time to recompose herself. When she comes, I will meet. But here they are. Maggie attempts to make a dash for the house in her shuffling way, but I stay her with my hand. Come back here, I say. And she stops and tries to dig a well in the sand with her toe. It is hard to see them clearly through the strong sun, but even the first glimpse of leg out the car tells me it is Dee. Her feet were always neat-looking, as if God himself had shaped them with a certain style. From the other side of the car comes a short, stocky man. Hair is all over his head, a foot long, and hanging from his chin is a kinky mule tail. I hear Maggie suck in her breath, is what it sounds like when you see the wiggling end of a snake just in front of your foot on the road. Dee next. A dress down to the ground in this hot weather. A dress so loud it hurts my eyes. There are yellows and oranges enough to throw back the light of the sun. I feel my whole face warming from the heat waves it throws out. Earrings gold too and hanging down to her shoulders. Bracelets dangling and making noises when she moves her arm up to shake the folds of the dress out of her armpits. The dress is loose and flows, and as she walks closer, I like it. I hear Maggie go, again. It is her sister's hair. It stands straight up like the wool on a sheep. It is black as night, and around the edges are two long pigtails that rope about like small lizards disappearing behind her ears. Wasuzo Tiano, she says. coming on in that gliding way the dress makes her move. The short, stocky fellow with the hair to his navel is all grinning, and he follows up with, "Assalamu alaikum, my mother and sister." He moves to hug Maggie, but she falls back, right up against the back of my chair. I feel her trembling there, and when I look up, I see the perspiration falling off her chin. "Don't get up," says Dee. Since I am stout, it takes something of a push. You can see me trying to move a second or two before I make it. She turns, showing white heels through her sandals, and goes back to the car. Out she peeks next with a Polaroid. She stoops down quickly and lines up picture after picture of me sitting there in front of the house with Maggie cowering behind me. She never takes a shot without making sure the house is included. When a cow comes nibbling around the edge of the yard, she snaps it and me and Maggie and the house. Then she puts the Polaroid in the back seat of the car and comes up and kisses me on the forehead. Meanwhile, Assalamu alaikum is going through motions with Maggie's hand. Maggie's hand is limp as a fish and probably as cold despite the sweat, and she keeps trying to pull it back. It looks like Assalamu alaikum wants to shake hands but wants to do it fancy. Or maybe he doesn't know how people shake hands. Anyhow, he soon gives up on Maggie. "Well," I say, "Dee." "No, Mama," she says, "not Dee. Wangaroo Liwanika Kimanjo." "What happened to Dee?" I wanted to know. "She's dead," Wangaroo said. I couldn't bear it any longer, being named after the people who oppress me. "You know as well as me that you was named after your Aunt Dicey," I said. Dicey is my sister. She named Dee. We called her Big Dee after Dee was born. "But who was she named after?" asked Wangaroo. "I guess after Grandma Dee," I said. "And who was she named after?" asked Wangaroo. "Her mother," I said, and saw Wangaroo getting tired. "That's about as far back as I can trace it," I said. Though, in fact, I probably could have carried it back beyond the Civil War through the branches. "Well," said Assalamu alaikum, "there you are." I heard Maggie say. "There I was not," I said, "before Dicey cropped up in our family, so why should I try to trace it that far back?" He just stood there grinning, looking down on me like somebody inspecting a Model A car. Every once in a while, he and Wangaroo sent eye signals over my head. "How do you pronounce this name?" I asked. "You don't have to call me by it if you don't want to," said Wangaroo. "Why shouldn't I?" I said. "If that's what you want us to call you, we'll call you." "I know it might sound awkward at first," said Wangaroo. "I'll get used to it," I said. "Ream it out again." Well, we soon got the names out of the way. Assalamu alaikum had a name twice as long and three times as hard. After I tripped over it two or three times, he told me just to call him Hakim a Barber. I wanted to ask him, was he a barber? But I didn't really think he was, so I didn't ask. "You must belong to those beef cattle people down the road," I said. "They say Assalamu alaikum when they meet you too, but they don't shake hands. They're always too busy feeding the cattle, fixing the fences, putting up salt lick shelters, throwing down hay. When the white folks poisoned some of the herd, the men stayed up all night with rifles in their hands. I walked a mile and a half just to see the sight." Hakim a Barber said, "I accept some of their doctrines, but farming and raising cattle is not my style." They didn't tell me, and I didn't ask, whether Wangaroo, Dee, had really gone and married him. We sat down to eat, and right away he said he didn't eat collards and pork was unclean. Wangaroo, though, went right on through the chitlins and cornbread, the greens, and everything else. She talked a blue streak over the sweet potatoes. Everything delighted her, even the fact that we still used the benches her daddy made for the table when we couldn't afford to buy chairs. "Oh, Mama," she cried, and then turned to Hakim a Barber. "I never knew how lovely these benches are. You can feel the rump prints," she said, running her hand underneath her along the bench. Then she gave a sigh, and her hand closed over Grandma Dee's butter dish. "That's it," she said. "I knew there was something I wanted to ask you if I could have." She jumped up from the table and went over in the corner where the churn stood, the milk in it clabber by now. She looked at the churn and looked at it. "This churn top is what I need," she said. "Didn't Uncle Buddy whittle it out of a tree you all used to have?" "Yes," I said. "Uh-huh," she said happily, "and I want the dasher, too." "Uncle Buddy whittle that, too?" asked the barber. Dee, Wangaroo, looked up at me. "Aunt Dee's first husband whittled the dash," said Maggie, so slow you almost couldn't hear her. "His name was Henry, but they called him Stash." "Maggie's brain is like an elephant's," Wangaroo said, laughing. "I can use the churn top as a centerpiece for the alcove table," she said, sliding a plate over the churn. And I'll think of something artistic to do with the dasher." When she finished wrapping the dasher, the handle stuck out. I took it for a moment in my hands. You didn't even have to look close to see where hands pushing the dasher up and down to make butter had left a kind of sink in the wood. In fact, there were a lot of small sinks. You could see where thumbs and fingers had sunk into the wood. It was beautiful, light yellow wood from a tree that grew in the yard where Big Dee and Stash had lived. After dinner, Dee, Wangaroo, went to the trunk at the foot of my bed and started rifling through it. Maggie hung back in the kitchen over the dishpan. Out came Wangaroo with two quilts. They had been pieced by Grandma Dee, and then Big Dee and me had hung them on the quilt frames on the front porch and quilted them. One was in the Lone Star pattern, the other was Walk Around the Mountain. In both of them were scraps of dresses Grandma Dee had worn 50 and more years ago, bits and pieces of Grandpa Gerald's paisley shirts, and one teeny faded blue piece about the size of a penny matchbook box that was from Great Grandpa Ezra's uniform that he wore in the Civil War. "Mama," said Wangaroo, as sweet as a bird, "can I have these old quilts?" I heard something fall in the kitchen, and a minute later the kitchen door slammed. "Why don't you take one or two of the others?" I asked. "Those old things was just done by me and Big Dee from some tops your grandma pieced before she died." "No," said Wangaroo, "I don't want those. They are stitched around the borders by machine."
"That'll make 'em last better," I said.
"That's not the point," said Wangaroo. "These are all pieces of dresses grandma used to wear. She did all this stitching by hand. Imagine." She held the quilts securely in her arms, stroking them. "Some of the pieces, like those lavender ones, came from old clothes her mother handed down to her," I said, moving up to touch the quilts. Dee, Wangaroo, moved back just enough so that I couldn't reach the quilts. They already belonged to her. "Imagine," she breathed again, clutching them closely to her bosom. "The truth is," I said, "I promised to give them quilts to Maggie when she marries John Thomas." With the mossy teeth. She gasped like a bee had stung her. "Maggie can't appreciate these quilts," she said. "She'd probably be backward enough to put them to everyday use." "I reckon she would," I said. "God knows I've been saving them for long enough with nobody using them." "I hope she will." I didn't want to bring up how I had offered Dee Wangaroo a quilt when she went away to college. Then she had told me they were old-fashioned, out of style. "But they're priceless," she was saying now, furiously, for she has a temper. "Maggie would put them on the bed, and in 5 years they'd be in rags, less than that." "She could always make some more," I said. "Maggie knows how to quilt." Dee, Wangaroo, looked at me with hatred. "You just will not understand. The point is these quilts. These quilts." "Well," I said, stumped, "what would you do with them?" "Hang them," she said, as if that was the only thing you could do with quilts. Maggie, by now, was standing in the door. I could almost hear the sound her feet made as they scraped over each other. "She can have them, Mama," she said, like somebody used to never winning anything or having anything reserved for her. "I can remember Grandma D without the quilts." I looked at her hard. She had filled her bottom lip with checkerberry snuff, and it gave her face a kind of dopey hangdog look. It was Grandma D and Big D who taught her how to quilt herself. She stood there with her scarred hands hidden in the folds of her skirt. She looked at her sister with something like fear, but she wasn't mad at her. This was Maggie's portion. This was the way she knew God to work. When I looked at her like that, something hit me in the top of my head and ran down to the soles of my feet. Just like when I'm in church and the Spirit of God touches me and I get happy and shout. I did something I had never done before. Hugged Maggie to me and then dragged her on into the room, snatched the quilts out of Miss Wangaroo's hands, and dumped them into Maggie's lap. Maggie just sat there on my bed with her mouth open. "Take one or two of the others," I said to Dee. But she turned without a word and went out to Hakima Barber. "You just don't understand," she said as Maggie and I came out to the car. "What don't I understand?" she wanted to know. I wanted to know. "Your heritage," she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, "You ought to try to make something of yourself too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it." She put on some sunglasses that hid everything above the tip of her nose and chin. Maggie smiled, maybe at the sunglasses, but a real smile, not scared. After we watched the car dust settle, I asked Maggie to bring me a dip of snuff. And then the two of us sat there, just enjoying, until it was time to go in the house and go to bed. So there it is. I love that story. What is their heritage? I suppose is one place to start. Yeah. I'm sure it's confusing to them, as it is to me in my life. The last page has this paragraph. "What don't I understand?" I wanted to know. "Your heritage," she said. And then she turned to Maggie, kissed her, and said, "You ought to try to make something of yourself too, Maggie. It's really a new day for us. But from the way you and Mama still live, you'd never know it." So the way they still live is, in fact, their heritage. You know, but when I go back to Norway and climb up on the side of the mountain where my ancestors have lived for generations, and in fact some of my contemporaries in that family still live, I don't want to live there. There's three farmhouses for three different generations, because in Norway they don't think generations can live together peaceably. And I could go there and be a goat herd and, you know what I mean. There are two sides to that question about what your heritage really is. Is your heritage that, well, what do you think about that? What is your heritage? I mean, that's
history of the family and all those personalities and all those people. That's part of my heritage. It's certainly part of the heritage of the people in that story.
Mm-hmm.
What it is that shaped who they are.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Dee Wangaroo? What kind of a person is she?
Selfish.
She's trying to find her
self-centered.
Heritage.
Selfish, self-centered. She's trying to find her heritage. Say more about that.
She wants to be someone important, but she wants to connect to the past. She wants to gather some of her known heritage, and she wants to forget from some of her known heritage. And so she's trying to sort that out of what she thinks is valuable. And obviously, in her mind, what she thinks is valuable, she thinks they don't know about.
Sure. What's the role of the African name? It's like me being called Ingrid in a way, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's leaping over a lot of generations of painful slavery years, but it's hooking back into something. Can you believe it that she took the butter churn apart with clabber sitting in it?
Yes.
What? How are they going to finish making butter?
Exactly what I
I think in a way she wants to deny the lowly heritage she had and not claim it for her own, but perhaps say this was my ancestor's struggle or something by the display of.
But she was in fact,
she wants to rise above it though.
But she was going to show it off to him, and she was going to display these artifacts from her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way she's saying, I grew up in a three-room house in a cow pasture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And look where I have gone.
Yeah.
And look where I've gone. There you go, Hertha. A little bit, yeah. It did make it a little more removed. Exactly. That was true also of the quilt.
Yeah.
They had been made by two of her ancestor D's.
I thought there was a lot of mixture of things going on for her. I thought there was a lot of shame, you know, at least in her earlier years of her family and her background and whatever. And later on, I think maybe partly because our society now is kind of making a big thing about your heritage and the quilts and the whatever, that maybe now she wanted to come out and claim some of this stuff.
The quilts, good. But a quilt and a butter churn, parts or whatever, will not ever tell anyone that she grew up in a three-room shack. The cornhole's ruined those.
How the pictures?
Yeah, why did she take those photographs?
Oh, the photographs, yeah.
Notice that she got out of the car and did not go and touch her relatives, her mom or her sister. She turned back to the car and got the Polaroid and took a lot of photographs, according to the story, before she returned the Polaroid to, and you know how long each Polaroid takes. I mean, you have to, it comes out and it develops and you take another one. And then eventually she came and kissed her mother on the forehead.
It's almost as though she's proud of her greater heritage, the African American heritage, and changing her name and sort of wanting to claim on some of those roots, but she's not as pleased with her immediate family or her intimate family. That's why maybe the needing for kind of for some tokens or some showing of heritage, but not the immediate intimacy with her own mother's family.
Is there any evidence that that's changing in her? I mean, think about teenagers that you know and young adults and people getting to be 30 and getting married. And she went through, before they raised the money to send her off to school, the mom and the church raised the money. She was very, it sounds like the mom at that point thought she hated her sister Maggie. She evidently was very angry at the heritage. When they sent her to college, she would not take a quilt. Do you think she's changing?
Well, to a point. But remember, she is taking only artifacts and still pictures, not the individual people with her. She did not invite her mother and her sister to where she was.
But she had said at one point that she would never bring a friend to visit her mother. She said, I'll come to visit you wherever you choose to live.
She will not friend or take her mother to where she lives.
But now she did bring a friend.
And when she first arrived, she wanted to be called her African name.
Wangaroo.
And the D is dead or forgotten, but then she kind of backed down from it. I get a sense, too, that when originally I said the heritage, I felt that the love and care that Maggie and the mother had for each other was the heritage, not
that Dee was apart from that heritage and that she wanted to just take the symbol, the surface part of the heritage, but maybe inside of her she wanted to touch back to that other heritage, but just somehow do it. And then went back setting up the walls again.
I think she had a longing for a heritage, but she had a shame of her heritage,
yeah,
too.
I wonder whether anybody here could say with a clear conscience that you would like to be just like your mother.
I would, because my mother died when I was 4 years old. I think of her as a beautiful person. And so that would be something I would want, but that's also because I didn't see her as an adult.
And you didn't see her in the late 20th century, you know, or whatever, however we change because of the way our culture changes. Who knows? I mean,
I didn't have to, butt heads with her at any point.
You didn't have to go through the teenage years.
I can come real close.
Can you? And how about you?
I think, for myself, I pray for, my mother has some beautiful qualities, and then she has some that really annoy me, and I pray that I would be given more of her beautiful, genuine, honest concern for others, just more of those. But every now and then, I look in the mirror, and as I get older, I look very, very much like my mother. See myself doing things that would be exactly my mother, and there's some of the little annoying things, and I think, do I have to take this with that? Of course I do. Just like I pass off with my daughter.
Who looks quite like you, incidentally.
Yeah. My friends have mistakenly called my mother me, or we've gone vice versa. People have called me my mother's name.
Yeah, I'm pretty unequivocally positive about my mother too. I just think she's fabulous. I don't think I'm like her, but I really have no qualms at all with how she is.
You want to say, I was actually going along with the laughter. I really genuinely would like to know whether I knew her later on or not.
Yeah. And then you can only reclaim bits of memories and
That's awful why I think that character is trying to have something in here. Because I feel very sentimental about the objects that were in my family because I want to have some connection.
Mm-hmm.
I can picture them sitting down, all three of them, maybe 20 years after the story took place, and laughing about, remember Dee when you came back with that fancy name? And, you know, just kind of sitting down and having a good laugh about all the changes that they all went through.
That's what I would hope for.
Yeah, and sure, because she seems to be sort of progressing that way.
A lot of black folks that I know that have taken African names have kept their African names for 20 years, but they, or 10 or however many years, but they are, like all of us, when you get older, you sort of temper stuff, and they don't always wear African clothes, or, you know. So I think there is some, I think that urge in Dee is pretty healthy in lots of ways. Now let's talk about the other daughter, Maggie, for a minute. What's Maggie like?
Not exceptionally bright.
Not exceptionally bright, but she has a memory like an elephant.
Yeah.
She knows history. She knows her family history. So even though
it sounds like she's very skilled at doing things, probably at caretaking, at running a household, doing those kinds of things, while the other sister went off to learn things out of a book, as opposed to learn how to make quilts or make butter. Or
is Maggie like her mother?
Mm-hmm.
in that she's satisfied with the life
yeah.
style that her mother has. She seems to be.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Maggie has internalized the heritage. She's just not getting the mental from her, but she is the heritage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's the real living person that will carry her.
At one point, the image in the story of her scarred hands being the hands that can do the quilting and that have the sort of memory of how to do the stuff that they'd have to do to live there. It seems like her heritage is in her hands in a way, both in the scars and in the knowledge of how to do everything. Maggie has a lot of characteristics of the mom, I think, but I would say not all of them. How do you think they're different?
She's missing the self-confidence and the high self-esteem that her mother has. Her mother knows who she is and what she is, and she's pretty proud of it.
Yeah.
I think Maggie's afraid to look outside. Mm-hmm. Her mom doesn't seem to be afraid of Dee. She just sort of accepts her, and Maggie seems to be a little bit overwhelmed by her.
I think lacking the self-confidence, she could never fathom moving outside of this way of living either.
And the future that we're given every reason to believe will happen to Maggie is that of getting married and to this man.
Three-toothed guy.
Yes. And, you know, living probably nearby in the same community, doing many of the same things her mother has done.
I don't think Maggie has that need to.
Do you think Dee was evil in some serious way? I mean, about like the fire. Do you think Dee caused the fire or didn't help her sister when her sister was burning in the fire? Did you get some feeling around that?
Yeah, I did, but I wasn't clear what it was.
I definitely get that feeling out of it.
You get the feeling that Maggie is fairly happy and maybe has friends. They didn't say it, but the contrast in there are they talked about Dee's lack of friends, so then I assumed Maggie had friends. Mm-hmm. Kind of a contrast. Mm-hmm. And that she feels good until the sister is going to come. You know, when the sister goes and she feels good again. So there is a deep thing between the two sisters that probably no one knows about.
Mm-hmm. Except the mother is the narrator, which I think is an interesting way of telling this story, because Alice Walker decided to make the mother know a lot as narrator. The mother can explain in depth to us many things about the way these children are thinking, why they're children, young women. We don't know exactly how old. But the mother gives us a lot of insight into both of her children's thinking. She can interpret their behavior. She tells us Maggie will feel this way until Dee leaves. She understands why Dee does certain things. So the narrator is very sophisticated, I think. Mm-hmm. And
she
narrator,
knows her children very well.
And she's the mother. And she, I mean, like that scene with the quilts where she describes Dee pulling the quilts back and not letting her touch them. I mean, she didn't miss the nuance there. That mother had it completely understood those girls and understood what was happening. So I think the mother is a very intelligent, sophisticated person. Her thought.
I wonder if the mother was a Maggie in her younger years, and the mother
How did the mother know enough to organize what must have been a Herculean task of sending Dee to college? Nobody went to college out of that social class, out of that racial stuff. I mean, poor, dirt farming, black family, a mom and two girls, and the mom decides to send one of those kids to college? The mother saw the intelligence, she saw the need to know, she saw the gifts that Dee had that could best be used by further education.
Yeah. Here's how
I think Maggie will have that too when she's a younger
child. Mm-hmm.
Here's how I was thinking about that. I was living with Maggie being empowered by her mother's
action of taking back the quilt and giving it to her. When I heard that Maggie had a real smile at the end, I wasn't thinking it was because Dee was leaving, but because she had been given her heritage or herself had been affirmed. And then I said, well, did the mother ever do that for Dee? And I said, of course, when she raised the money to send her to college.
And set her loose as a bird flying.
Empowered both of them. And, you know, part of the bittersweet irony of that is the mother knows it perfectly well, but the daughter is still blaming her and taking a kind of complicated, critical, and yet somewhat distantly approving stance towards the mother.
The mother raised or responded to the two girls very differently as a mother, it sounds to me like, but in each case appropriate to that child's gifts.
But then with the discussion about the fire, I think that the fire may have emotionally wounded Maggie.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was home trying to recreate that home that had burned for her. And
mm-hmm.
And her mother saw that Maggie never could go away because of what she experienced in the fire.
Because she was scarred for life.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But with Maggie's case, I think there's a real strength inside of her that maybe she hasn't seen yet. But she has that underground, a real peaceful strength, that gentle spirit that I think she will meet out, and she will find her own place. And it's not as flashy as Dee. She didn't have the college education that Dee had. She just has that inner core that is more important, I think, than what Dee had.
Yeah, she's not bitter about the fire. Well, in that affirmation of Maggie is treated like a revelation, it's just like when the Spirit touches me in church and I feel happy.
That's right.
I knew I had to do it.
Yeah.
And Dee's more bitter than Maggie, but Dee wasn't burned any time.
It's interesting that I think that this, in such a short story, 12 pages, she shows growth in all three characters.
Mm-hmm.
I think they all change, and she lays out change for us in a fairly clear way in all three of those characters. I wouldn't have denied Dee. I mean, I think it's wonderful that she could set Dee free and realize that this child was never going to be satisfied where she was. And she figured out how to get her out of there. I think that's miraculous, the strength of that woman. It's the same as bashing in that animal's head and having it hung up by nightfall.
I'm kind of curious, as mom, for compromising. I guess it must have been that important that she didn't give one to each daughter. And I guess it must have placed enough importance that they had to stay together, the two quilts, or that the power that it would give Maggie. I don't know. But
you're right. That's the absolute, that's what most people would have done. Two daughters, two quilts, what's the problem? So why did she do it the way she did it?
Interesting.
She had already promised them to Maggie.
Well,
commitment was
already. Yeah, she had tried
already. She was
already
giving gifts to each child as they needed them.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie needed those.
I think Maggie needed
them. Dee needed an education. She got that. They were unequal gifts, but they were the gifts that each one needed.
See, I
that's
thought
very
that Maggie
good.
Had been jealous of Dee for a long time. Of her talents, and in this way, I think the mother probably saw that she could do something for Maggie, and say you're important too.
Yeah, no, I think you're both right. This comment about to each child was given what the child needed, which meant that the mother was very wise. But it's odd in a way that the mother hadn't given enough affirmation to Maggie before that day. That Maggie felt wouldn't have needed that so much. But when the mother saw that she needed it, then the mother grew and changed, and the mother did something decisive.
It was the right moment to do it, too, because Maggie needed the gift that would take something away from her sister or keep her sister from having something.
Yes,
Dee would,
that's
Dee would,
right.
She could have affirmed her every day in the absence of her sister, and it wouldn't have meant as much as getting both
that's
those
right.
quilts from her sister.
Mm-hmm.
And Dee would be all right.
Sure. In fact, what did you think about? That was really a fight that went on there.
Yes.
I mean, I know that I'm Norwegian and uptight and that it's hard for me to have fights, but by my definition, that was a fight.
Yes.
and it felt tense.
I was surprised she didn't take a stand with the butter churn. That's something she used every day. Yeah. What was she going to do?
If that was for herself, she was a giving enough mother. If that was for herself, she could let it go. But this was for her child, and it needed to be a strong stance. She was protecting Maggie.
Yeah, I think she gave her a real gift when she mm-hmm. said, no, these belong to Maggie.
And there were witnesses besides the two girls, which I think is really neat.
Yeah. But then after the fight, Dee Wangaroo didn't just stomp out of there and leave in a blaze of glory. The mother and Maggie followed her out to the car. They kissed goodbye. They said some appropriate things. They followed through in a very, what I thought, a very civilized way. And they didn't just break communication. I mean, they managed it somehow. They didn't let this break the family apart. They continued talking. They were appropriate in farewells, I thought, which I thought was a pretty mature, on all three of their parts, thing to do. That they didn't let this major change, probably, or upheaval or something, major refocusing. Yeah.
I was struck by the images that were drawn of the two girls. The image of this dog has been struck by a car and comes head ball up to a deep headed to reaffirm. And then when Dee arrives, she's in her regalia with this brightly colored dress that sends off waves of heat. Two very different pictures in the dog.
And light and dark. Mm-hmm. Dee was lighter. The dress was like a fire. One interesting thing that obviously I've read the story many times and most of you have heard it once, so you can't pick out these little things, but there were many images of bright light around Dee and associated with that fire. And the fire association with Maggie was negative, the black skin, the black pieces of charred stuff falling off of her, and her dark eyes unseeing. But then at the end, Dee puts on enormous dark sunglasses that cover everything but the tip of her nose. And so she puts on some darkness before she gets in the car and leaves. And then Maggie laughs at her.
I got a picture of her when she put those sunglasses on as hiding.
Mm-hmm.
Going back into hiding.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously dark glasses can work as an image of a lot of things, but I thought after all the glory and light and bright and sun and gold and stuff we'd surrounded Dee with, then all of a sudden to put these dark glasses on her whole face seemed to me to be telling us something. And maybe it's telling us that Dee has been affected, has been changed, and probably for the better. I think Dee is probably on a good growth. Line two. I mean, I think the fact that she brought her boyfriend or husband or whatever he was home was good, and that she will gradually get tighter. I'm more optimistic than Hertha is on that point. I think she'll get a little closer to that family as time goes by. I could be wrong.
Well, I think we'll all go through part of that, and that's part of the separation of that, from part of growing up.
Mm-hmm.
We go back, and then later on we come back, and this role playing.
Uh-huh.
So I don't feel that negative about Dee at all. Because we've all done it. Even if we don't admit it, we all did it during our high school years and college years. And all of a sudden we saw the light.
And you come back with more appreciation, with more... And in a way, it's when you become self-confident enough to come back into that family and be a strong, full person, that you come back. And I think in my history, at least, my relationship both with my family and with the church are on that same model, that as a teenager and young adult, you have to kind of separate yourself from all of those things and somehow gather your own strength and make sure you're okay. And then you're strong enough to come back into your heritage, your loved ones, your family, your church, your whatever. I do think that that's true about this.
One thing about the situation that's very, very different from my own experience is that there's no mention of a father. And in my memory, I was always proud of my father. I don't remember ever being embarrassed with my father. I loved to be with my father. And it's only in recent years that I've learned to appreciate my mother at all. I really have, even in my early 30s, I think I still found it embarrassing. And so, you know, compare that to this situation where there's no father in the scene at all, even the memories, as I recall from the story. And so that's a whole different kind of constellation. Right?
Yeah, but this is a story about a single-parent household.
I know, Pertha, but I think my experience is dramatically different.
Oh, well,
because it wasn't a single-parent household.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, I think I identify with Dee in a lot of ways. But it's a much different experience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing I think is sort of universal would be that when she comes into her family with her bright clothes, she looks, the family is looking for her and everybody notices her and she looks so wonderful. But when she leaves and puts her dark glasses on, she's kind of just one of the people in the world and just no longer stands out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Mm-hmm.
I would just like to reflect on the way this conversation had gone. Your first question was heritage. And, of course, it caught me because I am the mother of a daughter of my own. And I have two adopted children and one is a daughter. There are 10 years difference between my children. And heritage has no meaning, in a sense. Mm-hmm. For my adopted daughter. And so I'm just so pleased to see the direction where we have forgotten heritage, basically, in much of our conversation, and have looked at the individual, the pluses and the minuses of each person here in this story, each daughter, the mother, and you know, respected the mother for her insight. Those of us who teach as well, I think have made some huge come arounds in the last 2 years. I have always believed that mother or that father standing in front of me knows a great deal more about that child than I could ever possibly.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. I, you know, you could use heritage in a variety of ways, and what these kids got from living with that woman, I think, is interesting. I mean, there's some senses in my mind where each of them got part of their mom. The mom I think of as a poet and as an expressive person, that I think Dee got those verbal gifts and the ability to see into life in some interesting ways. But yeah, strictly speaking, heritage is not as important, I think. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I guess I can't quite see Dee growing. And I keep seeing her as a taker.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if there were a sequel to the story five years down the road, where I'm yearning for is that she comes back and she's really perceiving these people as having nothing, and that she's been able to get an education and do all these things. I want to see her bringing the gift back to the family, not coming to the family and taking away what she perceives as the treasures that they do have.
Yeah. She has a long way to go. She is pretty unacceptable in most ways. You're right. I just think it's important to highlight that she's not totally unacceptable. But.
And I was very pleased that the mother's... When she came in and corrected her mother on what her name was, I know how I would have responded. And I would not have been quite as generous.
No.
That mother was very hip, I thought.
Very, very... I don't know what the word is. It's all forgiving and yet assertive when she needs to be, but I would not have responded that way.
She just said, teach me the name. I'll use it.
She was
respectful in a way because she's observing who her daughter is. She's not saying, you are what I made you. You are the name I gave you. She's saying, okay, this is who you are. I'm observing you as an individual person.
Well, she gave her permission to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think She's old enough and mature enough and wise enough to know that there will be another stage beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think one of the things going on there for in me is control. You know, I always think that my kids would be better off if I could control them totally, sort of organize their lives for them, which of course is not true. And